Chapter 39. Nicholas seeks to employ himself in a new capacity, and being unsuccessful, accepts an engagement as tutor in a private family. The first care of Nicholas, next morning, was to look after some room in which, until better times dawned upon him, he could contrive to exist, without trenching upon the hospitality of Newman Knox, who would have slept upon the stairs with pleasure, so that his young friend was accommodated. The vacant apartment to which the bill in the parlor window bore reference, appeared, on inquiry, to be a small back room on the second floor, reclaimed from the lease, and overlooking a soot-bespeckled prospect of tiles and chimney pots. For the letting of this portion of the house from week to week, on reasonable terms, the parlor lodger was empowered to treat, he being deputed by the landlord, to dispose of the rooms as they became vacant, and to keep a sharp lookout that the lodgers didn't run away. As a means of securing the punctual discharge, of which last service he was permitted to live rent-free, lest he should at any time be tempted to run away himself. Of this chamber, Nicholas became the tenant, and having hired a few common articles of furniture from a neighboring broker, and paid the first week's hire in advance, out of a small fund raised by the conversion of some spare clothes into ready money, he sat himself down to ruminate upon his prospects, which, like the prospect outside his window, were sufficiently confined and dingy. As they by no means improved on better acquaintance, and as familiarity breeds contempt, he resolved to banish them from his thoughts by dint of hard walking. So, taking up his hat, and leaving poor Smike to arrange and rearrange the room with as much delight as if it had been the costliest palace, he betook himself to the streets, and mingled with the crowd which thronged them. Although a man may lose a sense of his own importance, when he is a mere unit among a busy throng, all utterly regardless of him, it by no means follows that he can dispossess himself, with equal facility, of a very strong sense of the importance and magnitude of his cares. The unhappy state of his own affairs was the one idea which occupied the brain of Nicholas, walk as fast as he would. And when he tried to dislodge it, by speculating on the situation and prospects of the people who surrounded him, he caught himself, in a few seconds, contrasting their condition with his own, and gliding almost imperceptibly back into his old train of thought again. Occupied in these reflections, as he was making his way along one of the great public thoroughfares of London, he chanced to raise his eyes to a blue board, whereon was inscribed, in characters of gold, General Agency Office, for places and situations of all kinds inquire within. Apostrophe it was a shop front, fitted up with a gauze blind and an inner door, and in the window hung a long and tempting array of written placards, announcing vacant places of every grade, from a secretary's to a footboy's. Nicholas halted, instinctively, before this temple of promise, and ran his eye over the capital text openings in life which were so profusely displayed. When he had completed his survey he walked on a little way, and then back, and then on again. At length, after pausing irresolutely several times before the door of the General Agency office, he made up his mind, and stepped in. He found himself in a little floor-clothed room, with a high desk railed off in one corner, behind which sat a lean youth with cunning eyes and a protruding chin, whose performances in capital text darkened the window. He had a thick ledger lying open before him, and with the fingers of his right hand inserted between the leaves, and his eyes fixed on a very fat old lady in a mob cap, evidently the proprietress of the establishment, who was airing herself at the fire, seemed to be only waiting her directions, to refer to some entries contained within its rusty clasps. As there was a board outside, which acquainted the public that servants of all work were perpetually in waiting, to be hired from 10 till 4, Nicholas knew at once that some half dozen strong young women, each with pattens and an umbrella, who were sitting upon a form in one corner, were in attendance for that purpose. Especially as the poor things looked anxious and weary. He was not quite so certain of the callings and stations of two smart young ladies who were in conversation with the fat lady before the fire, until having sat himself down in a corner, and remarked that he would wait until the other customers had been served, the fat lady resumed the dialogue which his entrance had interrupted. "Cook, Tom," apostrophe said the fat lady, still airing herself as aforesaid. "Cook, apostrophe said Tom, turning over some leaves of the ledger. Well, apostrophe, read out an easy place or two, apostrophe said the fat lady. Pick out very light ones, if you please, young man, apostrophe interposed a genteel female, in shepherd's plaid boots, who appeared to be the client. Mrs. Marker, apostrophe said Tom, reading, Russell Plus, Russell Square, offers 18 guineas, tea and sugar found. Two in family, and see very little company. Five servants kept. No man. No followers. Apostrophe, oh lore. Apostrophe, apostrophe, tittered the client. That won't do. Read another, young man, will you? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mrs. Reimig, apostrophe said Tom, Pleasant Plus, Finsbury. Wages, 12 guineas. No tea, no sugar. Serious family, apostrophe, ah, you needn't mind reading that, apostrophe interrupted the client. Three serious footmen, apostrophe said Tom, impressively. Three, did you say? Apostrophe asked the client in an altered tone. Three serious footmen, apostrophe replied Tom. Cook, housemaid, and nursemaid. Each female servant required to join the Little Bethel congregation three times every Sunday with a serious footman. If the cook is more serious than the footman, she will be expected to improve the footman. If the footman is more serious than the cook, he will be expected to improve the cook. Apostrophe, I'll take the address of that place, apostrophe said the client. I don't know, but what it mightn't suit me pretty well. Apostrophe, here's another, apostrophe remarked Tom, turning over the leaves. Family of Mr. Galanble, M.P. 15 guineas, tea, and sugar, and servants allowed to see male cousins, if godly. Note. Cold dinner in the kitchen on the Sabbath, Mr. Galanble being devoted to the observance question. No victuals whatever cooked on the Lord's Day, with the exception of dinner for Mr. and Mrs. Galanble, which, being a work of piety and necessity, is exempted. Mr. Galanble dines late on the day of rest, in order to prevent the sinfulness of the cook's dressing herself. Apostrophe, I don't think that'll answer as well as the other, apostrophe said the client, after a little whispering with her friend. I'll take the other direction, if you please, young man. I can but come back again, if it don't do. Apostrophe, Tom made out the address, as requested, and the genteel client, having satisfied the fat lady with a small fee meanwhile, went away accompanied by her friend. As Nicholas opened his mouth, to request the young man to turn to letter S, and let him know what secretaryships remained undisposed of, there came into the office an applicant, in whose favor he immediately retired, and whose appearance both surprised and interested him. This was a young lady who could be scarcely 18, a very slight and delicate figure, but exquisitely shaped, who, walking timidly up to the desk, made an inquiry, in a very low tone of voice, relative to some situation as governess, or companion to a lady. She raised her veil, for an instant, while she preferred the inquiry, and disclosed a countenance of most uncommon beauty, though shaded by a cloud of sadness, which, in one so young, was doubly remarkable. Having received a card of reference to some person on the books, she made the usual acknowledgement, and glided away. She was neatly, but very quietly attired. So much so, indeed, that it seemed as though her dress, if it had been worn by one who imparted fewer graces of her own to it, might have looked poor and shabby. Her attendant, for she had one, was a red-faced, round-eyed, slovenly girl, who, from a certain roughness about the bare arms that peeped from under her draggled shawl, and the half-washed-out traces of smut and blackleed which tattooed her countenance, was clearly of a kin with the servants of all work on the form, between whom and herself there had passed various grins and glances, indicative of the freemasonry of the craft. This girl followed her mistress, and, before Nicholas had recovered from the first effects of his surprise and admiration, the young lady was gone. It is not a matter of such complete and utter improbability as some sober people may think, that he would have followed them out, had he not been restrained by what passed between the fat lady and her bookkeeper. When is she coming again, Tom? Asked the fat lady. Tomorrow morning, replied Tom, mending his pen. Where have you sent her to? Asked the fat lady. Mrs. Clark's, replied Tom. She'll have a nice life of it, if she goes there, observed the fat lady, taking a pinch of snuff from a tin box. Tom made no other reply than thrusting his tongue into his cheek, and pointing the feather of his pen towards Nicholas' reminders which elicited from the fat lady an inquiry of, "Now, sir, what can we do for you?" Nicholas briefly replied that he wanted to know whether there was any such post to be had as secretary or amanuensis to a gentleman. "Any such?" Rejoined the mistress. "A dozen such." "And there, Tom?" "I should think so," answered that young gentleman. And as he said it, he winked towards Nicholas, with a degree of familiarity which he, no doubt, intended for a rather flattering compliment, but with which Nicholas was most ungratefully disgusted. Upon reference to the book, it appeared that the dozen secretaryships had dwindled down to one. Mr. Gregsbury, the great member of Parliament, of Manchester Buildings, Westminster, wanted a young man to keep his papers and correspondence in order, and Nicholas was exactly the sort of young man that Mr. Gregsbury wanted. "I don't know what the terms are, as he said he'd settle them himself with the party," observed the fat lady, "but they must be pretty good ones, because he's a member of Parliament." Inexperienced as he was, Nicholas did not feel quite assured of the force of this reasoning, or the justice of this conclusion, but without troubling himself to question it, he took down the address, and resolved to wait upon Mr. Gregsbury without delay. "I don't know what the number is," said Tom, "but Manchester Buildings isn't a large place, and if the worst comes to the worst it won't take you very long to knock at all the doors on both sides of the way till you find him out. I say, what a good-looking gal that was, wasn't she?" "What girl?" demanded Nicholas, sternly. "Oh yes, I know what gal, eh?" Whispered Tom, shutting one eye, and cocking his chin in the air. "You didn't see her, you didn't, I say. Don't you wish you was me, when she comes tomorrow morning?" Nicholas looked at the ugly clerk, as if he had a mind to reward his admiration of the young lady by beating the ledger about his ears, but he refrained, and strode haughtily out of the office, setting at defiance, in his indignation, those ancient laws of chivalry, which not only made it proper and lawful for all good knights to hear the praise of the ladies to whom they were devoted, but rendered it incumbent upon them to roam about the world and knock at head all such matter-of-fact and unpoetical characters as declined to exalt, above all the earth, damsels whom they had never chanced to look upon or hear of, as if that were any excuse. Thinking no longer of his own misfortunes, but wondering what could be those of the beautiful girl he had seen, Nicholas, with many wrong turns, and many inquiries, and almost as many misdirections, bent his steps towards the place whither he had been directed. within the precincts of the ancient city of Westminster, and within half a quarter of a mile of its ancient sanctuary, is a narrow and dirty region, the sanctuary of the smaller members of Parliament in modern days. It is all comprised in one street of gloomy lodging houses, from whose windows, in vacation time, there frown long melancholy rows of bills, which say, as plainly as did the countenances of their occupiers, ranged on ministerial and opposition benches in the session which slumbers with its fathers, to let, to let. In busier periods of the year these bills disappear, and the houses swarm with legislators. There are legislators in the parlors, in the first floor, in the second, in the third, in the garrets. The small apartments reek with the breath of deputations and delegates. In damp weather, the place is rendered close by the steams of moist acts of parliament and frowsy petitions. General postmen grow faint as they enter its infected limits, and shabby figures in quest of francs flit restlessly to and fro like the troubled ghosts of complete letter writers departed. This is Manchester Buildings, and here, at all hours of the night, may be heard the rattling of latch keys in their respective keyholes. With now and then, when a gust of wind sweeping across the water which washes the building's feet, impels the sound towards its entrance the weak, shrill voice of some young member practicing tomorrow's speech. All the livelong day, there is a grinding of organs and clashing and clanging of little boxes of music, for Manchester Buildings is an eel pot, which has no outlet, but its awkward mouth a case bottle which has no thoroughfare, and a short and narrow neck, and in this respect it may be typical of the fate of some few among its more adventurous residents, who, after wriggling themselves into Parliament by violent efforts and contortions, find that it too is no thoroughfare for them, that, like Manchester Buildings, it leads to nothing beyond itself, and that they are fain at last to back out, no wiser, no richer, not one whit more famous, than they went in. Into Manchester Buildings Nicholas turned, with the address of the great Mr. Gregsbury in his hand. As there was a stream of people pouring into a shabby house not far from the entrance, he waited until they had made their way in, and then making up to the servant, ventured to inquire if he knew where Mr. Gregsbury lived. The servant was a very pale, shabby boy, who looked as if he had slept underground from his infancy, as very likely he had. Mr. Gregsbury? ?" said he. Mr. Gregsbury lodges here. It's all right. Come in. Nicholas thought he might as well get in while he could, so in he walked, and he had no sooner done so than the boy shut the door and made off. This was odd enough. But what was more embarrassing was that all along the passage and all along the narrow stairs, blocking up the window and making the dark entry darker still, was a confused crowd of persons with great importance depicted in their looks, who were, to all appearance, waiting in silent expectation of some coming event. From time to time, one man would whisper his neighbor, or a little group would whisper together, and then the whisperers would nod fiercely to each other, or give their heads a relentless shake. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.